this is the danger of reading headlines, Daniel Davis. On one headline, you'll say Donald Trump has successful or, you know, positive talks with Iran. Then the next headline, Iran says, nobody's talking to us. Well, it depends on who you're talking to. Things are in a state of disarray in Iran, with the Iranian regime leaders being knocked off. We had that initial missile strike, which wiped out a big chunk of the higher echelon Iranian leaders. They had the naming of a new supreme leader, this Mojaba Khamenei guy, which many people are calling the cardboard cutout supreme leader, because he hasn't been seen in the news since being named supreme leader. So his faction, the Iranian state media, is saying nobody's talking with Khamenei. He's never talked with him. But Donald Trump says, no, we're dealing with a man who I believe is the most respected and the leader. So Trump and his people apparently talking with someone with the Iranian regime, but not the supreme leader. Who's in control and who is capable of even sitting down and discussing with the U.S. or Israel or anybody else settlement or peace or opening up the strait? Daniel Davis, you have any ideas on that one?
Well, listen, a lot of the confusion comes from reading Western press. There's no confusion coming out of any of the Iranian side here. In fact, I spoke yesterday with a professor at the University of Tehran. I also spoke with Jeremy Scahill of Dropsite News, who had been in extensive conversations with a number of senior Iranian leaders. And then they had put out on their own social media. They have one side there, and they said that there are no negotiations, there are no talks. And what indirect talks they are, which they acknowledged, through intermediaries of Egypt and Qatar, have some pretty harsh terms of their own. It seems to be the U.S. side that's confusing what it is. And we're claiming, oh, it's not Mojtaba. It's actually somebody else. President Trump said it's some senior person that I'm not going to name. But the Iranian side says, no, there's just one guy in charge here. And there's many officials, just like there are in the United States, State Department, Department of Defense, the White House, et cetera. So I think that we're making more of this in the Western media than is the case, because the issue really isn't who's talking to who so much as it is what are the sides saying. Regardless of who on the Iranian side you're talking to, what are they saying and what is the U.S. saying? And we still have a situation with radically different ideas about what a negotiated settlement even looks like. Ironically and perversely, if I could say, we had a good deal on the table on the 27th of, actually the 26th of February, 2 days before this thing blew up. And now then the idea that we want to go back to something like that, it just seems pretty unlikely to me, because right now Iran has leverage over us that they didn't have before. So it seems pretty unlikely that they're going to just give in because they get bombed for, you know, 3 weeks or whatever it's been up to this point. Iran has shown they can suffer a long time. They suffered through 8 years of the Iran-Iraq war. They suffered through a war last year, all kinds of sanctions by the United States. So if we think there's going to be a quick reaction because we bomb them a lot here, I don't think we understand the nature of our adversary.
Well, and I've drawn the parallel, the analogy that it's, you know, like the cage, or like the cornered wild animal. You know, they find themselves in a position with life and death, and they just go absolutely berserk. They're going to do anything they want to keep the regime in power, even if it's been limited substantially from their military capabilities, right?
Well, I mean, it depends on how you define limited capabilities. From their conventional Navy, yeah, that's been virtually decimated. Their conventional Air Force basically didn't even exist before. But their Air Force, I mean, their missile force, on the other hand, is quite substantial. Their actual naval capability, especially with underwater capabilities, with underwater missiles / torpedoes, drone boats, speed boats, most of those have not yet even been brought into the fray. So those things are still very much active. And of course, everything focuses on the Strait of Hormuz. Who has control over that? And right now, for many, many military reasons, Iran holds that. So they hold the cards on keeping that open or not, which is why we've released sanctions on Russia, why we've released sanctions, ironically, on Iran itself, because we need that flow of oil to come out. So that's what really shows you the real nature of this and how concerned we are in the White House, despite a lot of these optimistic statements coming out.
And recognizing Iran's got this stranglehold over the Strait of Hormuz because of the mines and the ability to sink those ships, clearly it's shut it down. That's obviously been effective, demonstrably so. Look, nobody's going through. The world's suffering mightily because of it. But to that point, I see, at least I have read, that some of our European allies maybe starting to move in the direction of helping open up the Strait of Hormuz. I was looking at the terrible situation going on in Australia. They obviously didn't plan for the future, having enough reserves to last them more than 30 days. Their green energy problem, not mine, but that's another country that would benefit from opening the Strait of Hormuz. Now, as much as everybody apparently hates evil orange man, this suggests to me that they're going to have to get over that and say, listen, for the benefit of our own economies, because we rely so much, unlike the U.S., on the Strait of Hormuz, we got to get that thing open. Do you see that moving in that direction, or maybe that coming to fruition, Daniel?
You know what? I don't. I don't think we can also lose sight of the fact that the only reason we're in a war is because we chose to go into one. As much as people like to say there was an imminent threat, there's no evidence of an imminent threat. In fact, there's evidence that there wasn't one. But now that we are where we are, as you kind of say there. But here's the thing. There is no military solution to solve this problem. There isn't one. Iran has spent decades preparing a defense in the event that they got into a full-scale war, that they had the resources and the logistics stored up in places we can't get to them. And so far, they're demonstrating they have it. So this is really a test of wills right now. You go in there with the Navy. There's a reason why our Navy hasn't cleared this out yet, why we haven't escorted ships, because we know it would be near suicide because of their capabilities. And then bringing in somebody else, whether it's the Europeans or Australians or the Japanese or the South Koreans, it's not going to open it up. All it's going to do is create more targets for the Iranian capabilities to shoot at here. And that's why no one has done it, to include us. That shows you how difficult this is going to be to solve.
Well, and recognizing the rate of inflation going in Iran, it seems to me that, you know, whether they want to admit it or not, resolving this on some level is going to ultimately help their economy. I don't know how they can rebound from something like this.
Well, I'll tell you, though, Brian, here's the problem. If that was on the table, number one, we probably wouldn't have gone to war in the first place. But we've taken that off the table by saying it's regime change. It's the destruction of the regime is what we're going for. And so we have made it an existential threat. So whether they're suffering economically, and they are, whether they're suffering because they're not getting as much oil out, actually, so far, they have been getting more out. It's very strange. It's like 400,000 barrels a day more that they've been getting out than they were before. So make that make sense. But the bottom line is, no matter how much they suffer, we've made it to so they almost can't surrender and give up, because then their regime would fall. So now that they, as your analogy a second ago, now that we put them into a corner to where it's fight or die, and they're going to fight all the way through, and they have resources, they can drag this out a long time.
Well, interesting op-ed piece by Gerard Baker today. I thought it was rather astute, the idea of this asymmetric war. Yes, our military might overwhelms the Iranian military might, but they will declare winning for the Iranians would allow just keeping their I guess control structure in place to some degree. The same folks running
That is such an important point. The military balance of power, when you look at the spreadsheets, is just off the charts in our favor. There's no question about it. And you add in Israel to that as well. But the issue is, what is going to be necessary to win? For us, we have set a very, very high bar, which in my view is too high, given the fact that Iran is four times bigger than the country of Iraq, and we have no ground force. And by the way, it's not even four times bigger than Iraq. It's also the terrain, which overwhelmingly, because of these massive mountain ranges, advantages the defender in ways that Iraq couldn't do in 2003 and 1991. So they have an enormous advantage territorially and geographically. And so we have to go in there and say, we're going to decimate their military. We're going to get rid of their regime. We're going to get rid of the nuclear capabilities. And then we're going to get rid of their long-range missiles and their proxy forces. Those are targets that we have set. The militarily, those are just nearly impossible to gain, at least in any kind of a short term. Meanwhile, the Iranian side, all they have to do is two things. They have to survive politically to remain viable, and then they have to have a viable military sustained rate of fire with their missiles and with their drones. They don't have to blow away everything and eliminate Iran or Israel or anything else. They just got to stay viable and just keep on shooting and keep on hitting targets, which they're doing. Then they will eventually politically win, just like the Taliban outlasted us, just like Vietnam outlasted us. So many times, so many examples you can think of a weaker power that was decimated by a stronger military power. Look at Russia, Ukraine for that. Ukraine's the weaker power, but they've never given up, and they've, you know, 4+ years now. So all the recent evidence shows that if Assad has the will and it believes it's an existential fight, they can go for a long time.
most notably, and that seems to be the foregone conclusion here, given the limited amount of military power you need to keep the Strait of Hormuz shut down. So, and I got to ask you this because I have not seen anybody talking about it. I'm of the mindset that tick tock, going back to your part, that this wasn't an imminent threat. The clock on the war powers resolution is ticking, isn't it? 60 days without express authority, a waging of war by Congress, or an authorization for use of military force, neither of which we have. 60 days plus an extension of 30 days under the war powers resolution is all you get. Does that mean at the end of, let's say, 90 days, we're going to have to pull the plug on this?
No, let's just be honest. The War Powers Act doesn't exist. It's a piece of paper with no power. The constitutional separation of powers also doesn't exist because we blew through both of those. The 1973 War Powers Act does not say, despite popular belief, that the president has 60 days to do whatever he wants. It expressly says you only can use the military as the commander-in-chief if there has been a declaration of war, statutory authorization, or we were attacked. That's it. No other possibilities, no other authorized use of it. The only thing about 60 days is if we have been attacked and he responds, then he has 60 days in order to respond. So those are not even related to what's claimed, that he has the freedom of action. But since we didn't do anything about the Constitution itself, which says only Congress can declare war, and this is absolutely 100% a war, and we didn't get statutory authorization with the War Powers Act, that means that neither one of those hold any power at all. Nobody is going to follow that law. We just have to be honest about it.
Well, that seems to be sort of the kind of ad hoc approach we've taken since World War II with most of the conflicts we've been involved with, Daniel.
It's a fact. Yeah, this is not something new to the Trump administration. He's taken it further than anybody else has, but virtually every president has blown these things off. And this is the consequence, is now it's not just a missile strike here and there or a small action, but now it's a full-blown war that nobody in America had a chance to even say anything about. No one was asked, and we haven't followed our law. It's worse than it was.
But going back to my comment about maybe the other countries who've been financially impacted by the Strait of Hormuz, perhaps stepping up to the challenge in spite of the impossible nature of it, as you declared that it is, I guess I'm kind of a little concerned about that whole idea of World War III. So all those countries together, but then I've read reports that the Russians are helping the Iranians with signal intelligence and, right, and other intelligence, target striking and things. So the Russians are sort of using Iran as a proxy to keep this thing going.
Yeah, they are. And the Chinese, too. There's plenty of evidence, open source, even much less classified information. And they're definitely doing that. The Iranians have confirmed that they're getting some kind of limited help. There's also some kind of material help. But there's been plain loads of things coming in from multiple countries, and we can only guess what's inside of that. But it's one of those where the chickens come home to roost kind of deal. Obviously, that's what we've been doing for 4+ years in Ukraine against Russia. And now then they're returning the favor so far in smaller levels, but it is happening and it does appear to be useful and helpful to the Iranian side.
Yeah, I suppose Curtabout's fair play. We do that all the time with foreign conflicts, don't we, Daniel Davis? That's what the CIA is for, right? Daniel Davis Deep Dive. Always great having you on the 55 KRC Morning Show. Oh, and I've got to ask this out loud because somebody was screaming at the radio. You're talking about reliance on sort of Iranian media and Middle Eastern media being a little bit better than and more reliable than domestic. Somebody out there in the listening audience probably was screaming, yeah, well, Baghdad Bob, how can we trust anything those damn Iranians say or the other Middle East countries that may be caught into the side of the Iranians? Just very quick on that.
You got to be careful not to say, okay, because they said it, it's untrue, and because we said it, it is true. And that's exactly what I see. And if you're just looking at what's true, you got to look at what happens on the ground. And so far, they have been able to hit their targets. They have gotten through the air defense systems. The strait remains closed. Our Navy hasn't gone in. So if you're looking at what the reality is, you can make your own definitions.